But I think in my mom's
tape
family case,
three, side
it
two.
It may have been Hoffman. I
continued.
The story I pieced together, because you've got to remember, my sister was 8 years older than I. And so there is this peculiar jump in time. And it took me, I didn't think about it until I was in my late 20s, you see. And I sort of got some of the story from my mother. It was, what had happened is my sister was going to high school. And a kid in her class, and I still remember her name, was Christine. I sort of get mixed up with a bus driver. We lived in a small town, and this is not the sort of thing you do in a small town. And was pregnant, and the family threw her out. My sister came home, and I remember this sort of vaguely, these conferences, and told my mother. And my mother was appalled at the fact that her family would throw her out, and said, "You bring her right here." So Christine lived with us for about a month or two until her father came and got her, you see. But the thing that I never understood until later, and when I, it's funny how you put a whole story together and it becomes so simple. My mother used to say to Christine, "Now mind you, you don't have to marry this man." And that's the thing that got me. For a woman who was brought up in that sort of tradition, to have been that liberal in her thinking and comprehension that this poor girl didn't have to wreck her life by marrying this guy, I think was a I gives you a little insight into the woman. She always sort of in a strange way rejected us. Now that's going to sound funny, but it's not that. She was the first person there when you're ill, the first person to be very solicitous about anything. However, she, if I ever went to her house, this is in last later years, and she'd want me to come down for dinner, let's say, and I would. Right after dinner, she says, "Now you run along." And the whole idea was, she wanted me to live my life. She didn't want to ever impinge on anybody's freedom or right of life. And I don't know, I think that's sort of remarkable, because she, the greatest wisdom was that the more she did of this, the closer she drew all her kids. And so they're always with her to the nth degree. It's as simple as that. She used to take me as a child, I'll never forget this. We went shopping and sort of explained about clothing. She said, "Now you never want anything that's flashy and all that, you know." And she would get into all these, she gets very, very concerned, and actually taught me, literally taught me what I know. So I think a great deal of, if I owe anybody anything from a point of view of aesthetics, I think she's the one. And so that's about it. I can't say very much. She's always very concerned about behavior, this sort of thing. And
attitude toward Judaism?
You would have to understand that I knew my grandmother, her mother. I did not know a single other grandparent. My mother's father died much before I...
They came to America?
They were here, yeah. The whole family came over together. My grandfather died before I was born. My other two grandparents were dead before I was born. However, my grandmother was typical. It was a... Not... It was just actually a religious, if you know what I mean, absolutely devoid of it. There was no religion taught. My father could speak Hebrew. My father could speak many languages. And he, his father, was the village elder and the sort of village, I guess in a way, doctor. And while he had a religious upbringing, in fact, one of his brothers became the head rabbi of Scotland, and another brother was something or other in Blackpool. There's a whole section of my father's family went to England. Neither of them observed anything. I was brought up, it's taken me many years and an awful lot of reading to catch up and understand what's going on because I don't know. And I used to feel, I still feel very foolish when I ask some of these elementary questions. But I think, by the way, it was very wrong. But on the other hand, it was a very natural part of them. Nobody in my entire mother's family ever observed anything. I can't speak about my father's because they're all far flung. But my father did go on high holidays. He went to temple. And he went, not when I asked him once why he went, but never observed anything. He said, well, he says, because I am a Jew. It's as simple as that. And he, well, that's pretty strong. At the time of the war, of course, he was very upset. Some of my relatives actually were gassed and so forth. I don't know who, but I know they're part of his. He was part of, my grandfather had two wives and had an enormous family by both. And so that he ended up, my father was the youngest by the second wife. So the relationship between him and his oldest brother was that of almost a father and son. You can get the distance. And well, that's about it. My grandmother was a rather, everybody loved her except me, I guess.
What was her
name?
I
was scared of her.
What was her name?
Huh?
What was her name?
Her name was Marie Hoffman. But, boy, whenever I got into mischief, she would tie me down with one look of her eye and finish me. And I was only about, I couldn't have been about more than 7 or 8 when she died. But.
Did she live with you?
She stayed with little bits with all of her children. They sort of divided her up, and by the way, they wandered. And I could never understand that. But then again, as I say, I was 7 or 8.
Yeah.
What else do you want to cover now, especially?
You have.
No, that's so far, this is a great concern to me, this whole business of Judaism. It's only in, when you live in New York City, I will say, now I'm speaking about my own subsequent growth, as against living in a small town, New York is so preponderantly Jewish and controlled and all that, there is no sense of inferiority, no sense of anything.
Where did you live in New York?
We started out by, we lived on Drive as a family, Riverside Drive, 244 I think it was. And I lived practically all my life in Manhattan. I lived on 52nd Street, 40 East, between Madison Park, the greatest address in New York City.
What years are these we're talking about?
Oh, this covers quite a bit.
Yeah, okay.
Of course, my years of coming to New York about the age of 14, and when I left, I was 39. But in New York, one does not have this feeling at all. I had a strange reaction when I came to Pittsburgh. Because here, everybody was concerned about Judaism. In New York, nobody is. I've met a lot of people in New York who were well-known Jews, like Stephen Wise and that this sort of thing. But this meant very little to me. And first of all, it meant more as the war approached, and you became cognizant more and more of the dangers involved.
How is Pittsburgh different? How is Pittsburgh so different?
Pittsburgh's different insofar as the Jews are not in control of Pittsburgh. I don't like that word, in control. I mean, they were not. First of all, since I've been in Pittsburgh, I've always lived right here in the Oakland Shadyside District area. I was not Squirrel Hill. In Squirrel Hill, you have a different feeling, believe it or not. At least I do. But gradually here, I began, many of the people of my own age who were Jewish were very much involved, or were involved in some way with the temple. In later times, I got to know Rabbi Freehoff very well. In fact, he married Jane and myself. And a wonderful guy, quite a guy.
Well, your wife's family.
Although, frankly, I don't know who was the greatest. If he was the atheist or was I the atheist, I don't know.
Your wife's family was very prominently identified
with
Proto Sholem.
They were. In fact, I think Jane's grandfather on her father's side was, this goes around a turn of century or even before, was the shamans there.
Oh, that's interesting.
But you see, in time, I picked up a whole vocabulary. I picked up a lot of things. I've had it. And Jane often expresses shock that I don't know certain things. I don't. And that's all. I'm asking questions. I've been reading a good deal. That's about it. I think, by the way, it's my loss. I'm not trying to say this is anything. One of the peculiar things, too, is on coming to Pittsburgh, well, Jews are not expected to be museum men. As far as I know, I think I'm the first acknowledged Jew to become a museum director in the country. There are people like Rorimer, who was the head of the Metropolitan, who was, I don't know what he was when he came, when he took over the Met, but he was, used to pretend he was something or other, one of Episcopalian or something.
Spell his name.
R-O-R-I-M-E-R. Rorimer. Yeah. James Rorimer. There are others who, later times now, there are a raft of them. But there weren't, when I came in the game, I think I was the only Jew I knew of.
Are some of them identified with prominent museums today?
Yes. Today, Baltimore Museum is run by a guy named Lehman. L-E-H-M-E-N. For many years, the Walker Art Center was, what's his name? Friedman. It's very strange. You really want to see the core of this at work. It took me a long time. There was a man named Paul Sachs, S-A-C-H-S. This is part of the Sachs, so what is it? What's the name?
Goldman Sachs?
No. This is Paul Sachs. There's the Sachs family that ran the big brokerage firm
in
New York.
The Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs. I beg your pardon. I thought you said Walter. Goldman Sachs. He's part of that family. Paul Sachs became the head of the Fogg Art Institute, which is Harvard's great art school. It was the outstanding art school in this country. And to really make your way in this world, if you took the famous Sachs Museum Directors, a museum course, this was the beginning of your museum career. Gordon Washburn, who brought me here, was a typical Sachs boy. So was John Walker, director of the National Gallery, who came from Swickley, by the way. Most of the people in the game were emanated from Sachs. Not one Jew ever got a job through Sachs. Interesting, isn't it? Even his own nephew, I'm trying to think of his nephew's name, I know him, who got his job ultimately through himself and went up the hard way. But Sachs took a liking to Gordon, and Gordon became the youngest museum director in the country. He went to the Albright Knox's, well, at that time it's the Albright, as his first job in the world, and right out of college, and so on. But I'm just saying, you not only had what I would call either anti-Semitism or inherent anti-Semitism, or whatever you want to call it, which is not, they don't think they are, but you not only had that prevalent, but you actually had it from the Jews who were in the field. The art dealers, for the most part, were Jews.
From Lord Duveen downward.
From who?
Lord Duveen. Duveen? Joseph Duveen. D-U-V-E-E-N.
Wasn't he the man who did most of the buying for Elizabeth Gardner?
For whom?
Elizabeth Gardner in Boston.
That was Berenson. Berenson was a Jew, but mind you, he was never director of any museum or anything. He was purely, and by the way, the unfortunate thing is the subsequent stuff that's come out on him. He dealt with a lot of fakes, with a lot of things. He was responsible for a lot of unscrupulous activities in the field of art. I don't know what makes a man do this, unless he gets so completely full of the uselessness, I mean of his own. He was always an outsider, mind you, because he was a Jew. Why do you think he lived in Il Tatti outside of Florence? He lived there because he didn't have to face the United States. This is my thesis. I never met Berenson. He was be out of my age category. However, he was the man whom John Walker worked under, and was, John is still alive, by the way, but John is not that bright.
back to Pittsburgh. On the board, we had Josiah Cone, and we had Charlie Rosenblum.
Yeah, name another.
That's my question.
All right. There was always a Jewish trustee. Josiah Cohn was on the first board. And then when he went, Charlie took up the place. Charlie was a fabulous guy. I knew Charlie very well. And I want to say one thing. Have I spoken to you about him?
A little bit.
All right. You know my problems. He was a conversation ender and all that. Very difficult man to know. But he had a feeling of his responsibility, and he, more than anybody else on that board, acted on it. I had a very high regard for him. And he's the first man I know of, a trustee who ever got up and said, you know, he says, I don't know anything about art, really. And he says, I know I don't know anything about it.
Let's stop right there. And I want to tell you, it prevented my board from going on buying a whole stack of pot boilers that they had selected from without the advice of the director. That was Charlie. And he had tremendous wisdom. His wisdom was, well, he had a cultural base which I find others did not have. If you ever look at Charlie's library, it was quite something. I mean, the man had read. He had wonderful original documents, including one by Jefferson, which Lucille sold not so long ago. It's too bad. It's one of the great documents of Jefferson. He had certain likes which he let go, and he got all these wonderful drawings by William Blake, whom I love too, and you know, this sort of thing. And then he bought the fashionable things of the time too. And well, this is part of a man of that era. They all bought these etchings by the ton, you know, the outgoing guys, John Taylor Arms and others, who all are fairly insignificant. But you've got to understand the period and see how they fit into it. They did. No, Charlie is a man of culture. I could go to Charlie with my problems. I'll mention one other man while I'm at it, because I'm going to be very open about things. When I tell you, I did not like this man personally. He was a little man, and when he talked to me, he practically ran up me and always spattered all over you. But I'm speaking of Lowenthal, Alex. Alex did something which I greatly admire. He once came up to me. We had borrowed a picture of his for an exhibition. I don't remember the circumstance right now at all. As a result, he was invited to the special dinner we used to give for any fall show, our Founders Day show. He was invited to the dinner at the golf club, where all these dinners were held. And he came into my office and said, Leon, he said, well, this embarrasses you, I'm going down to see Jim Bavard, who was then president. He said, I'm going to tell him why I cannot accept his invitation. I will not go to a club that will not,
have Jews as members. Have Jews as members.
Will not member, will not have them and doesn't want them. And I said, no, go ahead and do it if you feel this
strongly.
Want to make a point of it. I think I was quite wonderful. And I was wondering, where in the world will we ever get a place? But I said, look, the issue is much more important than
the dinner.
Than the dinner. He went down and spoke to Bavard. About an hour later, Bavard called me up and said, Leon, he said, would you figure out another place where we can have our dinners? I was impressed. Mm-hmm. It took a lot of courage, because
yes,
Bavard is a man of considerable status in this city among the top echelon blue bloods here, you know.
But he was a committed Jew.
What's that?
He was a truly committed Jew.
Alex.
Yeah,
well, you see, I liked Anne very much, his wife. I used to get along with her very well. But Alex is a strange guy. I guess my resentment with Alex was he was always telling me about our
what was good and what wasn't. I guess that's part of it. Anyway, all that aside, I shouldn't really have.
He followed Charlie Rosenblum then on
the
board.
No, he never got on the board.
Oh, he was not on the board.
No, he went to painting in this part of mine.
Were there any other Jews?
The Jews first came on the board after my after I became director. There were, in fact, the whole damn city opened up, in case you don't know it. The only ones they ever had who were Jews were symphony directors, the conductors. They opened it.
Was the Falk family ever involved?
No. No, and Leon never gave any money to us. Nor did Bill Block. Bill came down on me the moment I you know, it's a sort of funny thing. You come to a city, you're here about a month, you're still trying to find out where the streets are and all that, and you're meeting people left and right, and you're in a confusion of your job, your social obligations, because that's very important in a museum, and all of this sort of thing. And here was Bill hammering away at me about museum better get rid of all those idiots on his board, you know, as though I was going to go up and tell him that. You go tell him.
So since then there has not been.
What's that?
Since.
No, Bill Block never gave anything. In fact, I'm not going to get into the subject of Bill Block. I have the great honor of having had an editorial written about me by Bill. A group of the architects over in Tech enlisted my help, and I got together with them. I ever tell you this thing about the bridge downtown? And I absolutely agreed with these architects. They were all teaching there, but they were the younger group. And they asked my aid because the city was going to demolish the Manchester Bridge. Do you remember the Manchester Bridge? Which was the finest bridge we had in the city, the most the most centrally located one. It's right at the point. And it did make sense because we were building the stadium, and this bridge would have, you could have walked across it and you were plunk right at the stadium. So I wrote this letter to the Post Gazette in defense of the bridge and saying it should be kept. But in view of the fact that it was not the best bridge for using vehicles and that sort of things on it, why don't we make it a walking bridge? Why not turn it into Pittsburgh's Ponte Vecchio? Why not have restaurants on it? It'd be a wonderful place in the summertime. Pittsburgh had no center. We needed a point where people could meet. It'd be a fabulous spot. It would serve everyone. And by the way, you could park your car anywhere, or you could take local transportation, walk across the bridge and go to your stadium, which by the way was the poorest place thing that ever happened, but let's not get into that. That's another thing. It went on in this way. So Bill wrote his editorial about these Johnny-come-latelys who know everything. This decision was made 20 years before, and obviously it should be kept. And some little girl wrote in reply saying 20 years ago, she said, I don't know whether to wear my hair up or down. I don't know who this woman was. She said, but I've become a woman since then. And she said, it's about time. The city changed its mind about many things too. Well, I finally found out the reason. I don't know which one of the boys downtown was, who's the man that was Stabile, one who had all the garages downtown. He had made a deal where he was going to have a ferry going from downtown, and you would cross for $2, you could cross the Allegheny, he'll take you down to the site of the stadium and back, you see. So it cost you a $4 round trip, and for this they took down the bridge. The only beautiful bridge we really had, and I mean a beauty.
It is so pathetic.
It's sad. But I finally got the bill. I got it one day. The 1970 International was reviewed by the New York Times and given the outstanding review I think we've ever had for any international since 1896. It was a
laudatory, I don't know what you're going to call it. And in fact, we got a lot of publicity on it. But Bill Block did nothing until finally, a little bit shamed, I think, by Donald Steinfurst. Because at that time, Jane, I don't know if either of you remember her, she was the art critic.
Milton
Jane's wife.
Yeah.
She was a doctor. Jeanette Jane, right?
Louis' friend, Freud's sister.
That's right.
See, and I was quite friendly.
Was she?
Yeah, she was Louise's.
No, not Freud. She was not a Freud. That's Morgenstern.
Well, Morgenstern was one, but she was another. No. I remember
her
when
name
she,
was
she died in Italy.
Who? Louise.
Donald's wife.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean. The first wife of Donald. Yeah.
That's right.
Because he married two James.
End of side two. Tape three. We will continue on tape four.
Anyway, we got this tremendous thing, and finally he was shamed into reprinting